And welcome again to the Ask Beattie Show. And isn't it the truth, my friends? It doesn't matter whether or not we are a celebrity or whether we are rich or poor or black or white or Jewish or Christian or Muslim or gay or straight or trans. We certainly all go through so many ups and downs in our lives. And what happens? What should we seriously do if we are on a never-ending merry-go-round ride or roller coaster ride? And I'm not talking about a fun ride at a circus, okay? If you're just finding that life is just not going in the way that you wanted, your relationship is not going in the way that you've wanted, you've tried a lot of things. You've talked to your friends, you've talked to yourself, you've exercised, you've done all in quotes the right things, and yet you're finding that you're really in a funk. And I'm hoping, in fact, today is the 276th Ask Beattie Show here on the Progressive Radio Network. And I always wonder whether or not every week there is some little thing that I say that hopefully is going to motivate and inspire you. We can't change history, but today you can begin to acknowledge and address and resolve as best as you can the issues that get in the way of your lives and of your relationships. I mean, for example, if we're talking about depression, and people are always surprised by these statistics. You know, for example, there are 16 million adults, and when I say that number every week, I know that number is low. 16 million adults in the United States, according to statistics, are suffering from true clinical depression, and that really translates into one in five Americans, 40 million adults suffering from a variety of different anxiety disorders. And again, in my practice in New York City and in East Hampton, most of the people who contact me, I would say that the, in quotes, presenting problems are depression or anxiety. But of course, we need to really look at what is the depression and what is the anxiety really all about. And this is where the quick fix, let's put a bandage on the infection kind of therapy, is the kind of therapy that I have always stayed away from. And I'm really so grateful for my McGill University training. I mean, we were really taught, it was in depth, to really get to the root of the problem, beginning at the beginning, which is typically where things happen. And that means looking at our families and looking at our family of origins and what happened and what did not happen. And have we not dealt with the abuse or the neglect? And, you know, so many people would like to very much, and I'm one of these people, because in my personal life, and you can ask my husband Jim about this, I am probably one of the most impatient people that you would ever want to meet. I want it yesterday. I want it now. And yet therapeutically and professionally, you know, I am extremely patient. And what I've learned over all of the years, and I've been practicing now for over 35 years as a psychotherapist and a sex therapist, is that we really do need to begin at the beginning. And even though we cannot change history, there is a way. There is a good way. It is not a fun way. It is not a tea party way. But there is a way to help people really emotionally work through once and for all what I call their unfinished business and skeletons in the closet. And when you do that, when you undergo that kind of in-depth therapy, and by the way, it doesn't take years and years and years to do this either, you are finally able to live in the moment. without having one foot in the past and one foot in the present. And what about relationship issues? We're not doing very, very well in this country. In fact, today's show, we are going to be talking about divorce, and I have a terrific guest who I'm going to be introducing very, very shortly. And people are surprised. I gave a presentation about a week ago, and when I ask audiences, do you know what the divorce statistics are? Well, people will say for first marriages, 50%. Well, it's a little less. We talk about 48%, 46%, but let's say it's close enough to 50%. And then I ask them, what about second marriages? Now, would it not make sense that if you have not been successful in your first marriage, that you would have a much better shot at doing a lot better in your second and third marriage? But the reality is that is absolutely not the case. And I really do understand why. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But for second marriages, the divorce statistic is 67% in the United States. And third marriages, and people are surprised, but that number for third marriages is 74% of people. They hope that after their first marriage, or actually before their first marriage, that they were going to live happily ever after. The first marriage didn't work. The second marriage didn't work. And also the third marriage didn't work. And as a Canadian, just before the show, I actually was very curious about the Canadian statistics. And in Canada, and I quote, 41% of marriages end by their 30th anniversary. So we Canadians, we are kinder, gentler, not as if we have relationship education in the schools. Although for those of you who've been listening to the show, you probably have heard me say that when I ran the school social services program for Greater Montreal, that was actually one of the things that I was able to do beginning at the first grade level to teach kids about healthy relationships. Of course, in those days, we didn't worry about health care, and in Canada, we still don't, and we didn't worry about budgets. So I think that what happens is that we're really left to our own devices to try to figure this all out on our own. And again, the reality is that we are not doing a very good job. Did you also know, this was something that I read this morning, the divorce industry is a $50 billion industry. There are 1 million divorces in the United States every year. One divorce. Can you imagine? Every 36 seconds, 2,400 divorces per day. And of course, the real question, and this is what I talk about all the time, is what can we do to prevent divorce in the first place? And again, for those of you who've been listening to the show, you know about my research, you know about my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And you probably heard me say, but I think it's really worthwhile repeating, that there are actually three things that we need to do so that we are going to have a healthy relationship and so that we will never make a mistake in love again. And the first thing, and there's just no way around it, we have got to be in a really good place ourselves, emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically, and we have to work through as best as we can our skeletons in the closet and the abuse and what happened and what didn't happen and our depression and our anxiety. Nobody's talking about being perfect, because perfection certainly doesn't exist. But if we are looking, you know, for the knight on the horse or for the princess to rescue and save us and make it all okay without our being okay, we are going to be very disappointed. And I used to tell my daughter Jordana when she was a little girl, I used to say, honey, relationships are very important, but the relationship has got to be the icing on the cake. We need to be the cake. We need to be the foundation. We need to be solid. And number two, and I talk about this all over the country when I give talks at universities and various different organizations, we need to educate ourselves about what ingredients actually do go into healthy relationships. And it doesn't matter how well educated you are. I mean, I see some of the best educated people in this country, and they know as little about relationships as people who have had very little formal education. So either we're going to become students of relationships, or we are going to continue to make the same mistakes over and over and over and over again. And then number three is my book. And I say this, I'm not pushing the book. I don't need to sell any books. But I did research with 450 people, and I came up with a formula. And people who know me know that I'm very bottom line. If it doesn't work, that's toss it. I have no use for psychobabble. So I have this formula that actually teaches people how to assess. Yes, assess. We assess cell phones. We assess computers. We assess what kind of roofs we're going to put on our houses. And yes, we do have to assess who our partner is and is not. And the thing that was a little disappointing for me with the research is that I found that it takes close to a year, unless it is so clear that we have to exit the relationship because there are just so many red flags, that it really takes close to a year to find out who somebody is and who somebody is not. Well, my guest, I have met a really terrific divorce attorney. And of course, you know, it's funny, Chaim, because I usually never say anything like that. I'll say the person appears to be this and that. But, you know, we talked at this event, and I really loved her approach. So my guest today is Chaim Steinberger. And he is a divorce attorney and a mediator and an arbitrator and a litigator and author of Divorce Without Destruction, which is something that really impressed me when we were talking. And Father, What Father? Parental Alienation and Its Effects on Children. He is the chair of the ABA Family Law Section Custody Committee. I mean, your bio, it goes on and on. And after graduating law school, Chaim worked at Schultz Roth and Zabel, clerked for Judge Edward R. Corman in the Eastern District, and worked at Morgan Lewis. And during this period of time, and I loved your honesty about this, and I'm sorry that you went through a divorce, but, you know, he says that he went through a rather nasty divorce, and it was at that time, right, that you said to yourself that there's got to be a better way. So welcome.
Well, thank you, Beattie. It's my pleasure to be with you here today.
Well, it's really great that you're here. And I want to ask you, was it really going through your own crisis? Because you've been a lawyer for a long, long time.
So I had been out of law school for several years, for 3 or 4 years. And I was working at large law firms. I was in a dark office building at 11 o'clock Saturday night.
Right.
It was, let's make believe, General Motors and General Electric had a $30 billion dispute over a turbine.
Right.
And I felt like I was wasting my life. You fix the frickin' turbine, you give them back some money, and let's move on with our lives. Why am I sitting here wasting my life with this? With the work that I'm doing today, I feel like I'm making a difference. When a father tells me, Chaim, you gave my daughter back her childhood.
Yes.
When a grandmother writes me and says, you don't know who I am, but because of the care that you took of my son, I now have spent a weekend. I always knew that I had a granddaughter around, and I never thought I'd get to meet her. But because of the care you took of my son, I've now spent my first weekend with my granddaughter. Thank you for making that possible.
And how important all of this, that really, really is. But it was your own divorce. Is that true? That really triggered this, this introspection that you wanted to practice a very different kind of law, something that was a lot more meaningful. Was that the trigger for you?
So divorce law is not one of the well-respected areas of law where people aspire to go into.
Right.
There are people who want to do good, and there are many women who want to go into divorce and family law because it appeals to them, because they like working with it. There are social service types who go into work, and and either represent the ACS, Administration for Children's Services, that takes children away from their parents when the children might be abused or neglected, and people who defend against them. So that those are the people that usually do. The large law firms generally don't play in this arena.
Right.
And it doesn't have the stature and the glamour of the large law firm practices. So it wasn't something I aspired to.
So it was your own. I know I'm going back to this. So it was your own divorce that really got you to ask yourself, what am I doing on a day-to-day basis? And there's got to be a better way for me to be spending my professional time.
Right.
That was it.
Right. That was it.
You know, one of the things that you'd emailed me and that I really loved, and I think that your understanding of the dynamics of divorce, it sounds like you really get it. You say that people don't fight because they're nasty and vicious. People fight because they're hurt, angry, and most importantly, afraid.
That's right.
Yeah.
So very often when somebody's fighting with us, we imbue them with a sense of viciousness.
Right.
We write them off as being bad people.
Right.
And if only we knew that they're not so much bad as they are afraid.
Exactly.
A therapist friend of mine sent me a New Yorker cartoon with a little, what appears to be a ball, a little animal in a balled up, and the lawyer standing in front of the witness stand and saying, "No, Your Honor, this isn't a hostile witness, it's just a scared armadillo."
Exactly.
And
exactly.
So when we're afraid, when we're scared, we behave in scary ways.
Exactly.
And people become scared. So if only we can connect with the humanity of the person who is our, shall we say, adversary,
right,
we can bring them back to the humanity place and then be able to work things out.
So tell my audience about your program, Divorce Without Destruction, Overcoming the Psychological Imperatives That Make Good People Fight Viciously. So, Mrs. So-and-so, now the majority of your clients, women or men or both?
I represent either, depending on who retains me and who pays me.
Okay. So, let's just say a woman comes in and she says to you, "My husband has had multiple affairs. He's leaving me for a younger woman, and I want you to rip him apart, and I want to get more than my fair share," which, of course, is 50% in the state of New York, right? Or maybe a little more, a little less, depending.
So generally, there's a presumption in the law that in a marriage of long duration, and sadly for us, a marriage of 7 years in New York is considered a marriage of long duration.
Interest, 7 years.
7 years is considered a marriage of long duration, and therefore, there's a presumption that there would be 50-50. You might vary off of that a little bit, 45-55, but in order to go much differently, in order to move off of that significantly, you had better have a really good reason. And the general rule, and this comes as a surprise to many, the fault, the reason why the marriage broke up, is not a reason for awarding somebody more or less property.
Because it's a no-fault state now, right?
Even before the no-fault part, even if, let's say, somebody is suing for adultery and got a divorce on adultery, they don't get less property because they were guilty of adultery. The law in New York is that we don't consider any fault unless it is so egregious as to shock the conscience of the court.
Like abuse?
And no, that doesn't do it.
It doesn't do it.
We've heard of that. There was a famous case that I just loved where this guy was working in the World Trade Center, and he fell in love with this guard who was there, and they marry, and they have several children, and they're in Puerto Rico, if I remember, and every day she's gone, or they're Disney World, and every day she's gone, and he takes the five children to Disney World, and every night she comes back. Well, it turns out that she had her boyfriend come down at the same time, and she spent the days with her boyfriend, and it turns out the child number five wasn't even his child.
Wow.
And he took that all the way up to the Court of Appeals, and he said, Your honors, this should shock you. That's not even my child. In today's day and age where we look at parental history, do you have any history of heart issues in your family? Knowing who your family is and knowing who your biological father is very important. This should shock you. Right. And the judges go, nah, we've heard it. We're not shocked.
So they're not shocked by it. What are they shocked by the way?
there was a case here in Manhattan where the woman was a big Wall Street broker, right. Made a lot of money. Husband was a taxi driver. And once while she was asleep, he picked up a pair of dumbbells and tried to bash her head in.
So that was shocking.
And that was shocking.
That was shocking.
Judge Jackie Silberman, then the chief administrative judge of all matrimonial matters for New York State, said that not only does he go away for attempted murder, but he forfeits his rights in the marital property.
Uh-huh.
So attempted murder does it.
But we don't shock.
An affair doesn't shock us.
Affair, domestic violence, abuse, not the sexual abuse. No, those aren't shocking things.
Well, if I read a case and the court has determined it, I can tell you this is the law.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, in the law, when you go to the extreme examples, it's very easy to call. You don't even have to go to law school to be able to say who's right and who's wrong. But the closer you get to the middle of that seesaw, because everything in the law is a seesaw where you're balancing rights against the rights on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And so the closer you get to that, to the center line of the seesaw, the harder it becomes to call it. And therefore, the more important it is to have a creative, good lawyer who can get up and make an argument to the judge to get the judge to rule in your favor.
But what if, like with my example, that this woman, she is furious. Of course she's scared. She's got three kids. She doesn't want to be alone. She's 59. She doesn't know whether she's going to find anybody else. And she says to you, my instructions, I'm paying you a hefty fee. I want you to try to destroy my husband.
So here's my approach.
Okay.
I would start by asking her, would you rather do better or would you rather do worse and destroy him?
And what typically would she or he say?
So I have had people who just, I knew I couldn't. So there's a very symbiotic relationship. I tell clients that having a lawyer is like ballroom dancing.
Yes.
That you need to be simpatico. The clients have a ton of information in their minds that I don't ever want to know, but running through them are veins of gold that I have to mine and I have to get out. And the only way I can get that without being overwhelmed by all the other stuff is by letting them know what I'm thinking and why I'm thinking it so that they can give me more of it.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be this relationship where we can talk openly and share. And where, especially when a client is on the stand, where it's like ballroom dancing, where if one person takes a larger step, the other person has to move along and take the larger step. If the person takes a smaller step, you have to accommodate. So you're constantly working in balance. You're working in tandem. So if a client wants to do something, that it depends how egregious it is. But generally speaking, people want to do the best that they can. They're afraid. To go back to the foundation of it, usually when somebody comes in that way, I want to destroy the other party.
Right.
They're hurt, they're angry, and they're scared.
Exactly.
If I can give them the sense of safety so that they're no longer scared, and if we can recognize, so here's the deal. People are angry at their partners. Why couldn't you be the person I needed you to be or I wanted you to be?
Right.
And if we come to the realization that we can't change other people. We can barely change ourselves.
Exactly.
Ask a smoker that you know how easy it is to stop smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so if we accept other people, I had this one woman came to me who said, oh my God, my husband, he's unreliable. He smokes pot all the time. He gets fired from every job. I asked him to watch my 2-year-old daughter, and he brings up a woman from Craigslist, and he has sex in the other room, and he leaves her socks all over. And after she had gone on for about an hour, I said, so by the way, tell me, why did you marry him?
And what did she say?
And she goes, oh my God, he was such a free spirit.
Uh-huh, exactly.
And then of course, so he's a free spirit.
Right.
There was a great New Yorker cartoon that read, so when did the things you loved about me become the things that you hate about me?
Isn't that the truth? So after you give people the real legal ins and outs and good advice that trying to destroy their ex is only going to cost them emotionally and financially a lot of unnecessary resources. They calm down, and then you explain your program and what exactly is the Divorce Without Destruction program.
I don't know that it's a program, but it's more an approach.
An approach.
It's a strategic, tactical approach that let me be strategic about it. I can be a tough negotiator without being offensive. I can look at the other side and be gracious and magnanimous. I call it powerful benevolence. Mm-hmm. Benevolence that comes from strength and power rather than timidity and meekness. Mm-hmm. And that makes all the difference. So if I've prepared my case well, and I know what the facts are, and I know what the law is, and I know I have the other side dead to rights, I can sit there in a gracious way and say, here's what I see it. There was this great article in the New York Law Journal a while back that said, cases that prepare for trial settle at mediation. Cases that prepare for mediation are forced to go to trial.
Interesting.
So it's the people that don't do the work. They go in there and they assume people are going to throw money at them. Mm-hmm. And nobody throws money at anybody.
Exactly.
So when you walk into a negotiation session, if I can show you how you are at risk of losing a whole lot, then you'll settle with me for something less than a whole lot. So I need to demonstrate to you why it's in your best interest to do what I'm asking you to do.
Now, typically, what are you finding these days are the primary reasons why your clients are seeing you for a divorce? Affairs or what? Or we just don't get along anymore, or I'm going through a midlife crisis, or what?
So I'll give you at once a profound and simplistic answer. They're not right for each other.
They're not
so
right.
So when one party has an affair, why did they have an affair?
Exactly.
Clearly they weren't connected. If my heart is tied up with somebody else and I live life and I walk on clouds every day and I just feel so connected to her, how do I get into bed with somebody else?
You're not going to.
I can't.
Exactly.
I can't. It'll just feel creepy.
Do you recommend that your clients, before they sign on the dotted line with you, that they go for counseling? Or do you at least ask the question, have you had couples counseling and tried to work this out before finalizing your marriage?
So to be very clear, my job is to effectuate the will of my client. So if my client wants to get divorced, I get them divorced. If they don't want to get divorced, I try to get them not divorced. So I've had two clients come to me whose spouses sued them for divorce, but they didn't want to get divorced.
Uh-huh.
And I told them what to do to win their spouses back.
You did.
And I did.
Well, let's hear the advice.
And it worked. Well, it was,
let's hear it.
It was specific
to
the situation. It was counterintuitive. We'll need another program for that.
Interesting. But, interesting. So you helped them get their spouses back.
I did.
I am impressed.
And I had Queen Supreme Court sent a case to me to mediate. We spent an entire afternoon. It was a 2.5 tissue box mediation session. We walked out of there. The wife's lawyer said, Chaim, I've got an MSW. I've got a master's of social work. I've never seen anybody do what you've just done in there. I said, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of weeks later, the court reached out and said, what's going on with the case? So I sent the lawyers an email saying, what's going on? They said, they decided not to get divorced. Mm-hmm. So apparently I took a perfectly good divorce and I effed it all up. So there is a way, there's a better way.
Yes.
And
well, there's a lovely song. I thought it was actually a fun song that Jesse, my producer, is going to play. It's called I'll Keep the Kids by Montgomery Gentry. I don't know whether you've heard this, but it's very cool. Okay, let's hear it. I'll Keep the Kids.
Can I add something to what I was saying earlier?
Absolutely. What did you think about the song?
It was interesting.
It was interesting. This was a sad man,
well,
but he understood, and what he really wanted was to make sure that the kids were going to be okay, and he wanted to keep the kids. But anyways, go ahead.
So here's sort of the basic philosophy. If people recognize that nobody has to be at fault in a divorce. So often people say, what happened? Who's at fault? And nobody has to be at fault. I can be a great guy and my ex-wife can be a great gal, and we're just not right for each other. We don't make each other's heart sing. We don't float each other's boat. Nobody has to be at fault. Nobody has to be bad. Nobody has to be condemned.
Right.
And so once you get to that place, like, I'm sorry, honey, that I couldn't give you what you needed, and I'm sorry that you weren't able to give me what I needed. Let's split up and let's move. I'm sorry that you feel betrayed. I didn't mean to betray you. I didn't mean to hurt you, but I needed to do what I needed to do to take care of myself and nurture myself.
If people would only, if they were only able to communicate with each other in that way, it would make all the difference in the world.
But they can't.
They can't.
So I gave this lecture this morning to the on Divorce Without Destruction, Overcoming the Psychological Imperatives That Make Good People Feed Viciously, to the Mediation Committee of the New York State Bar Dispute Resolution Section. And mm-hmm. as you know, a couple of weeks ago, I gave it to the American Bar Association Family Law Section meeting. Here's the deal. When we feel threatened, our subconscious amygdala puts us into fear mode, the fight, flight, or freeze mode. And as a defensive mechanism in order to ensure our survival, what it does is it shuts down everything that it thinks isn't important.
Right.
So when you think there's a saber-toothed tiger in the bushes, you forget about the blueberries you've been picking, and you can't worry about the exam you have next week.
Right.
And that's why PTSD is so powerful, because when you feel the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, when you feel that your basic survival is threatened, you can't worry about paying the mortgage or showing up to work on time.
Exactly.
So, and that's why I'm so much better at giving other people advice than I am to remember that same advice when I feel threatened. Because when I feel threatened, my brain laser locks into what I perceive as being the threat, and therefore I can't see all of those solutions. I can't be that magnanimous and benevolent and think with that open mind that everybody really is a good person and we're all just struggling to get through this thing we call life
and
make our best way through it.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I've been talking to lawyers. This is part of, I guess, my crusade, that if we lawyers can give our clients the sense of safety and comfort and make them feel nurtured and safe, then all of a sudden the clients would be able to broaden their vision. But until then, so often I've heard so many of my colleagues complain that the clients stay focused on one thing that isn't really important and refuse to focus with the lawyer on something that is important. But that's because they think they perceive that to be the threat.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to make our clients feel safe. And only once they become safe can they talk in this manner, can they have this broader vision, can they recognize that their future ex is a good person too, and something went awry, we're just not right for each other.
And you know, I think that, you know, listening to you as a divorce attorney, I mean, there would be tremendous impact on how you're saying it, what you're saying, which I think is typically not something that most lawyers, and certainly not most divorce attorneys, articulate in this kind of a way. I mean, I've worked with divorce attorneys in the past, and it was like, okay, let's put on our punching gloves here, and let's see, you know, who we can knock out in the first round, and if not in the first round. And I think just listening to the way you are expressing what needs to be done, because I feel that if people are able, you know, talk about being mindful about what is in our best interest, and I talk about this on the show constantly and with my patients all the time, so that people stop just reacting, you know, to fear and loss and anger, and just kind of stop for a moment and ask themselves, is this the best way for me to approach it in this situation? My divorce. So you're there as the safety figure, really. Not only as the lawyer who knows the law, but as the safety person to try to get them to emotionally and psychologically do what is also in their best interest, even though they're paying you and they may want you to be, you know, aggressive, or they may want you to do something which will ultimately be self-destructive and self-sabotaging for them. So it's an interesting role that you have taken on.
And it makes use of so many talents. This isn't an easy thing to do. So to make somebody, so there's an old salesman's expression, which is show, don't tell.
Yeah.
And this is true in advanced advocacy, when you want to demonstrate something to the judge rather than telling the judge, give them a concrete example. It's a lot more powerful. And here too, you can't make the client feel safe by saying, oh, calm down, you're being too dramatic.
No, condescending. That's really condescending.
Trust me, if you've ever had somebody tell you that when you were upset.
No.
So you know that doesn't work. So the only thing we can do is actually make the clients feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
So part of what, a number of years ago, I published an article for the American Bar Association called Make More Money by Being More Ethical.
Uh-huh.
And it turns out that clients, many lawyers misunderstand. Lawyers think that clients like it when they're cheap, or clients like it when they win. It turns out that the number one thing as to whether clients will hire a lawyer again is the care and concern that the lawyer shows to the client. So I go around talking to lawyers about, don't answer your emails when you're with your client. Don't let a client sit outside in the waiting room for an hour. Go out and escort them in, escort them out. Make them feel important. Show them that you care and concern. Now, of course, with all of that, you need to do the hard work of knowing the law, mastering the facts, so that you have it all at your fingertips. And when you get up in court, that you present a masterful argument. And so you've got to do the hard work to do that. Not everybody wants to do that hard work.
Right.
But it's part, this is something that can't be faked. You either have it, you either do the hard work, and you demonstrate to the client how you're committed to the client's end goal, or you fall short and the client senses that something is off, that they don't feel safe.
Let me ask you, how do your colleagues, I mean, time is money, and especially here in New York City, I mean, the hourly rates are just so absurd, so out of what I feel is something that's ethical and fair, and taking the time to nurture and care for and keep people safe and do all the things that you're doing. I mean, it takes time. And how do your colleagues respond to your approach? Generally,
I have had mixed reactions. I've had a client. I had the paradigm case. Boy meets girl, boy dates girl.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't work out, they break up. And 3 weeks later, he gets the most fantastic phone call any guy could ever get, which
is, I want you back.
Honey, you're going to be a father.
Ah.
And they're off and running to the race. By the time I get called into this, they have been scratching each other's eyes out.
Mm-hmm.
That every time the case is on in court, the judge can't sleep for a week before the parties are scheduled to appear.
Mm-hmm.
And they're fighting for every 5-minute increment. And I call opposing counsel before I'm even retained. I call opposing counsel because I knew him. And I said, look, if I come in, I want to change the dynamic. I want to create a safe space for each of the parties to hear and be heard. And
so what does your colleague say? I mean, how do your colleagues respond to this kind of a loving and caring approach?
And I must have repeated the word safe space once or twice, because he started mocking me with it. Safe space,
safe space. Yes.
3 months later, he called me up and he said, I have to apologize to you.
Uh-huh.
You did change the dynamic between the people. So it's possible. People don't know. You know the old saying, when all you have is a hammer, everything seems like a nail?
Mm-hmm.
People only know what they don't know, and we don't know what we don't know, and we can't imagine another way. So I know of horrific stories of colleagues of mine and how they practice and how they go about it. Scorched earth policies. Now, here's the problem. This is a divorce. It's not like a business partnership. It's not like you're suing somebody for the seller of a truck of goods. The children always know they only have one father and one mother.
Right.
They will never have another father. They will never have another mother. And It doesn't end when the children become 21 and child support stops. The kids can be 35 years old and they're like, oh, where do we go for Thanksgiving? Mom and dad both have dinners at the exact same time, and wherever we go, the other one gets angry. So we need to find a better way of working this out so that we can talk to one another. I frequently tell people, do you love your children more than you hate your ex?
I want to take just maybe a minute or a minute and a half, you know, talking about children, to play a little clip from Reba McEntire, Every Other Weekend. Now, these two sound like they want to get back together. They should come and see me. I mean, obviously, I mean, this Every Other Weekend business, it's so tough.
It is very tough for the children. The children didn't sign up for this. The children didn't ask for this.
They didn't.
And all children think that it's their fault. And studies show that children can bounce back from parents who don't like each other and stay married.
Yes.
Children can also bounce back from parents who get divorced. What children can never bounce back from is a long, nasty, drawn-out battle.
Exactly. And you tell your clients that, right? If for no other reason, let's do this well for our kids.
The longer the battle,
right,
the nastier the battle.
Exactly.
The more permanent the damage is. The children can now be 50 years old, and
right,
you walk into a cocktail party, and you take a look at them, and you go, there's something off about them.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm,
they can never bounce back from it. So all children know that they're part father and part mother. If children are told that one of their parents is all evil, then they absorb that part of themselves are all evil.
Mm-hmm.
And it sets up this dynamic within themselves that they can never accept themselves fully.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a form of child abuse, is parental alienation.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, through the mediation process, I would assume and I would hope, especially with you, that this would be brought up into a conversation as people are negotiating the child support and the houses and, you know, the financial kinds of issues. I mean, this is, when you think about it, I mean, this is the most important issue of all. You know, the family is broken up, and how do we operate as mom and dad? Of course, there, you know, you were saying before that, you know, some of the kids only have one father, and of course I'm in circles where the kids have multiple fathers and stepfathers and people coming and going, which just makes it so very, very difficult. But through the mediation process, I mean, I would hope that this would be at some point a focus of why we need to settle and settle well and not drag this thing out and destroy our children in the process for an extra $1,000 or whatever it's going to be.
So I would argue that whether I'm mediating, whether I'm advocating, whether I'm an advocate, a knight in shining armor on behalf of a client of mine, that if we start, if people often aren't really fighting over the thing they say they're fighting over.
Right.
It's so often, it's for status, it's to be recognized. And so if you talk to the other side with decency and integrity and civility, and you recognize their role in this, you recognize the father as being the father, you recognize the mother as being the mother, usually the other issues will get worked out. People don't stay so locked in. It's when people feel that their fatherhood is threatened where they don't really want to give the money, and so you think you're fighting about the money.
But it's not.
It's very often not.
Exactly. Do you typically sit in with the other side's attorney and client so that the four of you are sitting around a conference table trying to negotiate the various different issues and items?
So I welcome the opportunity to sit down in what we call a four-way meeting.
Yes.
And if I am a mediator, I want the lawyers and parties in the room, because I want the lawyers in there so that they see what's going on, so that if their client is about to make a misstep, they'll say, excuse me, Mr. Mediator, I need to explain something to my client. They'll pull the client out, and they'll have a talk, and they'll come back in and have a more sophisticated position.
Does that typically happen in that way, where the four of you are in a room and you're discussing and negotiating?
So many people think that mediation means one mediator and the two parties. I argue that it's much better for each party to have a lawyer at their side.
Absolutely.
And this way, because I've seen people hurt with mediation sessions, a mediator's job is not to protect one party or the other.
Right.
And so somebody wrote me just the other day, and I was like, let me be very clear. Do you want to hire me to be your advocate to protect you, or do you want me to be a neutral mediator where my job is to facilitate a resolution? And frankly, I'm less comfortable in that role when the parties don't have lawyers, because I want them to be protected.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care if it's a $1 million dispute. If people come in without mediators, that's okay. If you walk out with and you leave $500,000 on the table, you'll make it back. But in the divorce context, people's most crucial and fundamental interests are on the table. A woman's ability to be self-supporting for the next 15, 20 years.
Right.
A father's ability to maintain a relationship with his children hangs in the balance depending on what the ultimate deal is. And once it gets poured in concrete and it's signed by a judge, there's a huge hurdle to overcome to change it.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes really important to get that done and done right the first time around.
And then present what has been resolved to the judge.
Right. And generally speaking, the judges will sign off. There are some limitations. For example, if you're deviating off of the Child Support Standards Act, you need to give a reason. If the judge is unsatisfied, the judge has to repeat the reason why there's a deviation. By statute, he's required or she is required to. And so you need to know that if you're going to deviate off the Child Support Standards Act, you had better put down a sufficient reason that it gets accepted. But for the most part, as far as property distribution goes, if the parties agree to it, we believe in autonomy and letting people chart their own destiny. A judge probably won't double check that and won't look at that. So if you give it all up, a woman came to me, said she's 59 years old, she wants to retire, but she has no money. And I said, well, wait, why not? She goes, well, my husband was working all of our lives, 45 years we were married.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, what happened to his pension? She goes, well, he got it. I said, then what did your lawyer say? Oh, I didn't have a lawyer. We went to a mediator.
Oh, my. So it can be very dangerous. I mean, that's been my experience. And whenever I've been involved, even peripherally, in the mediation process with patients, there have always been two attorneys. So that's the way to go.
It can be very dangerous. And I'll just put a plug in for something relatively brand new called collaborative law.
Yes.
Where there are two attorneys, both lawyers and both clients sign an agreement that if either party leaves the negotiating table and goes to an adversarial system like litigation, both lawyers have to withdraw. So now there's a disincentive for anybody to torpedo the negotiations. There's an incentive to try, even when you think it's impossible. You give it one last shot, then you try really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And both lawyers are trained mediators. Instead of hiring two separate business valuators, you join in together and you hire one business valuator that comes back and says, well, this is what husband claims, this is what wife claims.
Mm-hmm.
If husband is right, the business is worth this. If wife is right, the business is worth that. This is what I think it's worth. And then you sit down and you negotiate it.
Mm-hmm.
So that, to me, is mediation with protection.
Absolutely. And mediation that really makes sense. So listen, how do people contact you?
So I'm on the web at www.thenewyorkdivorcelawyers.com, all spelled out T-H-E-N-E-W, thenewyorkdivorcelawyers.com, or you could type in my name, chaimsteinberger.com, and you can find me that way.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can, only because we were giving warnings, a big warning to people who want to sign prenups. So if it's the standard prenup where people say that whatever's yours is yours, whatever's mine is mine, then, and forgive me, I'm going to use a sexist stereotype for a moment. If a woman is going to have children and she's going to leave the workforce, she is at a great risk, because if 10 or 15 years later they get divorced, she walks out with nothing. And so if you have a prenup like that, do not leave the workforce. I was talking to a vocational expert. She said, even if you're going to work 2 days a month, 2 days a week, stay in there, network, continue to keep it, because if you don't have a guaranteed source of income, you have to make sure that you stay employable throughout the years that you have children and you're raising children.
Do you know that this is the first time that I'm hearing this? And I know that people don't know this. They don't have the information, particularly, you know, when things are going really well, you don't want to even go down that route. And yet life is fragile, and marriage is so fragile. And, you know, just like with the world of relationships, we're left to our own devices. And this is why I think it's really important that people take in what you've said, you know. And I really, you know, I rarely have guests. And, you know, when I met you, I thought that you had something really important and really substantial and ethical and moral to be able to, you know, relate to my audience. So, again, I want to thank you so much for coming in, and to be continued. And I want to thank all of you for listening to the Ask Beattie Show, Mondays live from 3 to 4. And, of course, you can always go to the Ask Beattie archives, where you can listen to my 276 shows. And I leave you with two very important messages that I actually give you every single week. But I really do want you to take them in. And the first is that you do everything that you possibly can do, and that includes getting help if need be. And it doesn't mean you're weak, it means you're strong, to find ways to really love yourself. And secondly, we all need to do a much, much, much better job in this world to find ways to love each other. So again, thank you for listening. Thank you for coming in, Chaim. Be well, everybody. And I will be with you next week. So take care.